Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media eCast, Overcoming the Most Time-Consuming DO-178C Objectives. I'm your moderator, Brandon Lewis, with today's speakers, Joe Vlad of Wind River and Sean Bhattacharya of LDRA. Before we begin, I'd like to more formally introduce our speakers, beginning with Joe Vlad, who is Senior Director of Product Management for Avionics Safety at Wind River. Joe has over 25 years of embedded engineering and marketing experience, including management roles at Safe Software Consulting, Trimble Navigation, Wind River, and LinuxWorks. His previous roles included work on GPS programs and the space shuttle at Intermetrics, Inc., aircraft test and certification at McDonnell Douglas Aircraft Company, and aircraft engineering at United Airlines. Joe is an FAA-designated engineering representative for systems and equipment and software. He is also an active instrument-rated private pilot and has co-authored three patents on GPS integrity functions. He holds a Bachelor's of Science in Aerospace Engineering from the University of Buffalo and an MBA from Santa Clara University. Our second speaker is Sean Bhattacharya, Business Development Manager at LDRA. Sean began his career in factory automation, robotics, and working with various defense contractors, including Lockheed Martin Missiles and Fire Control, where he finished his time as the Deputy IPT Lead for the MULE program. Sean has been with LDRA since 2007 and has worked closely with industry-leading system integrators across an array of markets, implementing security and safety-critical methodologies. He consistently writes for industry periodicals and speaks at leading conferences, such as the Embedded Systems Conference. He works with regulators, leading industry technologists, and tools and service providers to help projects adopt methodologies in practical, scalable ways. Sean is also an active contributor to the Future Avionics Capability Environment, or FACE, standard, drives product innovation with customers, manages partnerships, and manages LDRA's U.S. field engineering team.
Thank you, Brian.
Now for a couple of housekeeping items before we begin, starting with the features of your viewing console. The Enlarge Slides button will maximize the presentation slides to fill your entire screen. Second, the Download Slides button will allow you to download and print the slides if you'd prefer to follow along with a hard copy. Next, the Forward to a Friend button enables you to send an email that includes a registration link to this eCast so that friends and colleagues can also attend. The Ask a Question text box allows you to participate in the event by simply typing your question into the box and hitting the Submit Question button below. You can submit questions at any time during the course of the presentation, and we encourage you to do so early and often while reviewing the material. We'll address as many of these questions as possible during the closing Q&A, and also if you have questions about the eCast operation itself, you can submit those as well, and one of our technicians will be happy to assist you. Final note before the presentation begins is that all Open Systems Media eCasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded without prior permission. Now, to introduce Sean, the first speaker, take it away now, Sean.
Thank you, Brandon, and welcome to our webinar. Here we're going to be talking about what problems and challenges and solutions that LDRA have to offer, as well as Wind River, and we'll see a little bit about how the two technologies integrate together to further amplify their value and get you over those really time-consuming objectives of DO-178C. To start with, let's briefly look at a little background about LDRA. We've been around since about 40 years and been heavily involved in the DO-178B and now the C standards, the MISRA family of standards, the FACE standards, security standards. So we're very actively involved in driving the cutting edge of the methodology as the technology world evolves around us and safety critical requirements are ballooning everywhere, especially in the commercial avionics world. So our goals are to stay involved with these standards and drive the thought process and the methodologies, and at the same time build those practical tools to help make your life easier, and then being able to bridge them together and help you with from an advisory standpoint as well as an implementation and deployment standpoint to put those methodologies in practice in practical and scalable ways in your environment. So as you can see, MISRA committee members, 4 out of the 8 members actually work for us, and being able to build a pedigree of folks that know how to analyze lots of different variants of code, understand lots of different compilers and cross-compilers, gives us that underlying core technology that we can leverage across processes, coding standards and process standards alike. And it's just an example of some of the folks that, are represented on the standards. Dr. Michael Hennell, our CEO, is both on the MISRA committee and has been involved heavily with them, as well as really driving a lot of the DO-178 and B standard, and heavily involved in DO-178C. So we were involved in the original transition from DO-178A to B with Bill St. Clair and Dr. Michael Hennell. So moving on to the standard itself, you'll see that there's a whole lot of challenges that we have to really wrap our minds around and figure out how to tailor and implement in our environments, from tracing requirements and system level down to design software requirements, hardware requirements, down to code, and back up to the right side of the V model and the various levels of tests, mapping all these artifacts that are produced through levels of verification to objectives, meeting coding standards, applying data and control coupling analysis within your particular architecture and scope, performing structural coverage activities. Of course, we know they can be very time-consuming on the target environment or virtualized target, as we'll see with CIMICS, and even doing traceability down to object code. And finally, qualifying the tool chains and tool stacks surrounding these methodologies and providing that well-packaged bundle of evidence that can be easily reviewed for transparency and traceability. These challenges can make or break programs, and putting the right processes and technologies and people together really makes the difference of getting your product to market in a reliable and certifiable manner. A quick glimpse across the tools that LDRA offers. On the far left, you'll see the requirements traceability portion, and our technologies bring together elements from DOORS, Word, different types of modeling tools, all together into one normalized environment, where things can be linked together, traceability matrices can be produced, impact analysis can be assessed, both bidirectionally, as the standard requires. Moving on, the verification workflow engine allows you to distribute these requirements and tests across a collaborative team and apply tailored workflows on those particular tests that need to be produced, and all the results, both behavioral and structural coverage and code analysis, can all be aggregated, and the reports can be collated in an automated way. And of course, underneath the hood, the computer science components of the tool, the ones that are actually analyzing the code and checking to see adherence of coding standards, instrumenting code for code coverage, generating harnesses for low-level and unit testing, and integrating with the target, all that plays into these verification workflow engine and traceability components of the tool to be able to bring together sort of the hardcore computer science with the process requirements of the standard. So let's take a quick look at traceability in the DO-178 scope, and you can see in this slide that effectively requirements at different levels obviously need to be bidirectionally linked together, but in the DO-178 standard in particular, those requirements need to be traced all the way down through low-level requirements at very, very detailed, with detailed design information contained within them, all the way down to source code, and for level A applications, all the way down to object code to show traceability, because ultimately what's flying in the air is the executable object code. That's where that risk needs to be removed, and that's the application that we need to get to those levels of reliability, 10 to the minus ninth number of defects per operating hour. And for each level of requirements, they need to have subsequent test cases, test procedures, and test results, and those results need to be reviewed against those subsequent requirements to make sure that they were actually implemented in the system as expected. So when bringing together artifacts across these different environments, the challenges are these artifacts typically reside in different types of repositories. So you may have some requirements in DOORS, some requirements in Word, some in a model, and being able to link them all together in that normalized environment and be able to assess impacts of change as you iterate and release new versions of these is very important. Otherwise, the amount of traceability headache and the number of errors that could be introduced through improper bookkeeping, so to speak, could in fact derail program deliveries and introduce errors that may be latent defects that show up in after deployment. Ultimately, of course, those low-level requirements need to actually be linked to code. So typically this has been handled by putting comments in code with requirement IDs or putting prototypes within DOORs or Excel spreadsheets to be able to keep track of it. But this is pretty cumbersome, and especially as you're dealing with multiple product variants, you end up having multiple sets of tags. We solved this problem by simply dragging and dropping the prototypes directly onto those low-level requirements and keeping track of that metadata outside of the code or the requirements modules themselves, allowing you to overlay different levels of traceability over the same pieces of code. So if you're using the same mathematical function, same algorithm in multiple variants of a program, it may really be instantiated in different traceability matrix. So that's really important to keep track of, because this is where you see that huge explosion of a very large number of low-level requirements being connected to a whole lot of different artifacts, different elements within your code itself. So as we're discussing code and we're getting into the implementation phase, one of the objectives that you need to implement is that the source code needs to be uniformly designed and implemented, and it needs to conform to standards. And the best way to go with that is to select some coding standards that are typically off the shelf and tailor them. So if you're working with C code, MISR C 2012 with a bit of tailoring and apply to some specific practices that you find most useful within your environment is typically a way to go. Some of the challenges that you'll come up with is that you'll have some legacy code, some auto-generated code, some hand code, maybe a little bit of C++ mixed in. So the key is to tailor coding standards accordingly. If you're working with legacy code, maybe you'll be looking for certain types of latent runtime errors, no defaults at the end of case statements, and those kinds of things. And, of course, if you're writing greenfields applications, you can be a little bit more stringent and try to target a standard like MISR. So right adoption of a coding standard and proper tailoring based on your code base is the right approach, so you don't try to take a legacy application and fit it into something like MISR and in effect add more issues than you actually eliminate. And applying coding standards has a lot of other benefits. For instance, if you manage the cyclomatic complexity of your application, it tends to be that the individual functions that you're testing are a lot easier to trace to low-level requirements. They're a lot easier to get structural coverage of. They're a lot easier to reuse in different variants of your application. Applying static analysis early in the process can find things like unreachable code very early in the process. So you can refactor code or determine why the control flow won't allow you to get to a particular line or set of branches in your code. So there's a lot of additional benefits that come in from doing static analysis and coding standards adherence early in the process. And if you consider how that will in fact apply to verification down the road, you can really reduce your cost of verification. Just a couple of quick examples to look at from static analysis. On the code block segment on the left, you can see A plus B plus C equals X, and that A, B, and C are not all of the same type. So different compilers are allowed to interpret the C spec differently, and A plus B plus C may result in integer promotion in one order or another, and you may get different behaviors and different results for X as you move from one target hardware to another. So looking at using a coding standard, that particular piece of code is a lot more portable, and it'll tend to not introduce latent effects further down the road. And here's your classic case of a buffer overflow, where the buffers, the array A is declared to 10, but the loop is running to 20. And in real-life applications, of course, we typically don't see 10 and 20. We see a preprocessor directive that's buried 10 headers deep, and it's very difficult for the human eye to see that's the buffer overflow, whereas a tool can easily analyze and detect it. So let's look at verifying test cases themselves. This is a typical specification tree that you'd see decomposing high-level requirements down to low-level requirements and testing them both. And when you do this, not only are you executing those test cases, but you're reviewing the test cases themselves to make sure they're properly modeled, they're being reviewed against the requirements that were to be implemented, and the person authoring the test have considered how that requirement is supposed to behave and really model that test case accordingly. So this needs to be applied both for high-level test cases and for low-level test cases. And in typical DO178 methodology, your high-level test cases are executed first to verify that, in fact, you're getting the behavior expect, and then whatever holes aren't covered with structural coverage analysis from those high-level tests, they can be augmented with low-level tests to ensure that all your code has, in fact, been met through requirements-driven tests. Now, of course, with code coverage in mind, we need to have a good sense of what code coverage does entail and what it does for you. It's really measuring the effectiveness of testing. How effectively did that test the requirement and, in fact, execute the code that implemented that requirement, essentially ensuring that you're triangulating requirements, test, and the implementation, and ultimately ensuring that the expected behavior in that requirement ends up in that executable object code. So that's what that transparency gives you. And as we'll see further down through these slides, that integrating this within an RTOS environment gives you a lot of benefits. One of the first things that you get with the Wind River RTOS VxWorks, for instance, 6.5.3, they have a very dynamic environment, so you can create test cases on the host and download them onto the target, low-level tests, for instance, and then regress a whole series of tests back and forth through their downloadable kernel module architecture, for instance, and are able to not having to restart your target over and over. And as we'll see later, this is even further amplified when you put Simix in the loop. Let's take a quick look at the different types of code coverage. There's a statement coverage, ensuring every statement's been executed. A branch coverage, a branch decision coverage, ensuring that the true and false case of an atomic or compound conditional has been executed. MCDC coverage that actually verifies that if any element of that compound conditional affects the outcome of the entire expression, that needs to be tested, and effectively reduces the number of test cases to n plus one number of tests to thoroughly wring out that compound conditional. And this is required for level A programs. Data coupling and control coupling coverage, and we'll touch on that a bit more. In this case, it's really about data coupling and control coupling analysis and looking at data flow and runtime and seeing which data elements and set use pairs were in fact exercised. And that's what we're stating as data coupling and control coupling coverage. Object code coverage is effectively showing what kind of coverage has been achieved at the assembly level, which is one-to-one to the object code. And by regressing test cases, once you've achieved 100% MCDC coverage on the object code itself, one can clearly see what a compiler may have done to add additional code to the executable object code, and then be able to add additional test cases to exercise that code that the compiler has added. And finally, linear sequence code and jumps, LCSAJs, are path coverage, which is testing every possible path through the code. And very few standards actually require that, but it is possible. That's the ultimate, most exhaustive sort of structural coverage. Structural coverage takes up a lot of time. It's really important to be able to visualize structural coverage in various different ways. Run through a set of high-level tests and then find those gaps that are to be covered and hone in on those portions and create additional tests based on requirements to fill those holes. So the better you're able to visualize structural coverage and be able to determine what's not getting covered and what is, and the more you can automate it, the better. And with object code verification, this gives us a simple example of a flow graph on the left that shows us the control flow of source code at the C level, and on the right, the control flow of the same source code at the object level. So the control flow does get altered in the object code, and of course additional code can be added. And no compiler completely behaves deterministically. So the same code construct placed in a different part of the code could yield a slightly different bit of object code. And hence that addition of 6442B and A-79 showing that these additional tests have to be performed for level A systems. Ultimately, tests at all these levels, the high-level tests, low-level tests, even object code coverage, all that gives you kind of an aggregate structural coverage picture from your requirements-based testing. And that picture allows you to feel good about the fact that the expected behavior on the left side of the V has been correctly implemented in the source code and the executable object code and has been verified by the tests on the right side of the V. So doing these at different levels of granularity gets you those higher and higher levels of reliability. So I want to quickly touch on the data coupling, control coupling as a subject, and there has been some requests that we touch on it during this webinar, but essentially the definition for DO-178C, 6442C, has been slightly changed to show from a test review of the test design rather to a measurement of the test execution. So requirements-based testing has exercised the data and control coupling between components. And there's really two parts of that data and control coupling story. There's the data coupling portion that's ensuring that that set use pairs across software component boundaries have been exercised per your requirements. And so as test cases exercise those requirements, are those set use pairs, is that write to the global data structure which is being read by an algorithm, is that data stale or is it fresh? And do you know that that behavior in runtime? And that type of analysis, that type of rigor is now expected in DO-178C. So the analysis and the results produced by the LDRA tools not only give you the structural coverage, but essentially lay out the data elements, and they can be scoped down to the ones that are crossing these software component boundaries, and the specific set and use, the defines and references, can be captured in runtime. And this technology is qualified, of course, so it reduces your review burden. But ultimately, it does apply some significant automation to reduce your effort level required to get through doing this particular objective in a rigorous way. On the control coupling standpoint, really it's about have all the calling points from one function to another, have all they been exercised, and have they been exercised in accordance with what it's supposed to be in your architecture, in accordance with your high-level and low-level requirements. So if one of the calls from main to adjust lighting here in this picture, and there are two calls here, one of them has not been executed, then the question is, why hasn't it been executed? When I do run a requirements-driven test to test that requirement, do I get execution of the call that I'm supposed to? So that analysis in conjunction, both getting that procedure call coverage data and looking at that in the context of requirements and architecture is necessary to really do control coupling analysis properly. So just moving on from structural coverage and coding standards to just touching on the modeling world, and really where things are headed now is people want to do more and more work in the modeling environment, and they'd like to be able to run those models both in a simulation and emulation environment and on their target, and be able to do verification work at the model level and be able to leverage those tests further down the line. So these various modeling tools that you're seeing here in the picture, including StrelScade, Simulink, Rhapsody, they all provide this type of framework so you can create tests at the model level. And we've integrated with them so you can run and build those tests and then auto-generate code from those tests, pull them into our tool, along with the tests that were produced at the model level, and regress them on the target hardware where the rubber really meets the road and we need to confirm the behaviors actually happening as expected in the model environment. So moving on to tool qualification, and this has been a significant change in DO-178C as well. A separate supplement was written for it, and really tool qualification levels were defined for three different criteria, one through three. A verification tool like LDRAs falls in that criteria three category, and you can see that the tool quals that we've created have aligned with TQL5 for all levels of design assurance. And here's an example of our structural coverage qual pack, and you'll see the objectives that are affected are in table A-7, 5, 6, and 7. The way qual packs work are essentially tool operational requirements are verified through tests by the vendor and then shipped to the applicant, who then reruns those tests on their target environment with their cross-compiler and so on, and verifies that indeed that the tool is credible. And here's a tool qualification packages available for code review, for data coupling, control coupling, low-level testing, structural coverage, and really they're intended to reduce your review burden. So you can look at the pass-fail results, you can look at a structural coverage of 100% and take that as face value and not have to hunt down and verify the tool behaved correctly for every statement coverage piece of information that was provided to you. Now, when it comes to integration with Wind River, the way the LDRA tools fit is that when something is done in runtime, for instance, a low-level test is executed or structural coverage is attained, the tools instrument the application code, and that executable is run on VxWorks, for instance, or VxWorks 653, maybe on a Simix environment, maybe not on a Simix environment, maybe with a functional simulator for a compiler for a target, or maybe actually on the target hardware itself. Additionally, we've created a Workbench plugin for the IDE, Wind River's IDE Workbench, so you can work in one unified environment. You can develop and check your coding standards, rerun your tests, see where you stand in coverage, and so on and so forth, giving a much more sort of fluid workflow, and ultimately making it easier to get there and much more natural to the developer and much easier to adopt in your environment. And finally, we have the LDRA's tools continue to use some of the technologies that Wind River really leverages. For instance, there's a great IO redirectional layer that Wind River provides, so you can do target IO on the target and get the results back on the host. And these types of technologies really speed up the day-to-day workflow for verification engineers. So there are various points at which users can take advantage of it, including in the Simix environment, which Joe will go into in much more depth. And Simix provides us with a great way of rerouting its I/O so we can execute tests and get coverage data and behavioral data back to the LDRA tools in a very, very efficient way. And finally, this is a quick little screenshot of coding standards adherence within the IDE environment. So that way you're finding the issues before you check code into CM, and it's the most preemptive and most effective place in the development timeline to meet these types of coding standards. Ultimately, just a quick interesting note, Wind River is utilizing our LDRA tool suite to develop the VxWorks 7 applications certification package. And the two key techniques and technologies that really differentiated us was the object code verification capability of being able to get assembly-level coverage on various different targets. So Wind River, like many of us out there, are trying to port our applications to multiple product lines, multiple targets, and to be able to perform object code verifications on a wide range of targets and cross-compilers becomes very important. And finally, the data coupling and control coupling technology is really a unique capability that we provide because we do the data flow analysis and overlay it with structural coverage and can dramatically reduce the amount of time required to do this type of analysis manually with debuggers and so on. So ultimately, to really get your product to certification quickly and effectively and reliably, you need to be able to have these various control gates and various technologies helping you along the way. You cannot just be good at test. You can't just be good at traceability, but you really need to be competent across that life cycle. You need to be able to bridge various artifacts and teams across these life cycles. Otherwise, you're working in silos, and the free radicals build up, and they result in things falling apart. So with that in mind, I'll pass things along to Joe, and he can tell you a lot more about Simix and Wind River products and how we integrate together. Joe?
Great. Thank you, Sean. So I'll go ahead and start. You've heard now Sean talk about the entire lifecycle, software development and verification activities, and the activities that are involved in certifying to DO-178 and how their tooling environment supports that. What I'm going to talk about now is a tool called Wind River Simix, and we're getting a lot of questions from our customers today that use this product, and I'll give you an overview of the capabilities, but it has direct applicability into the DO-178 arena because of its powerful capabilities for simulating the environments in which people are trying to build their software. The natural question is, how can I use it to support DO-178 certification? So that's really the topic of my discussion today. But what I want to do first is kind of give an introduction into the capabilities and the driving needs for the tool set to begin with. So as we know, developing certified software really is a challenging endeavor. It's complicated. it involves mitigating all the risks and being very labor intensive and verifying the behavior of all the functionality that you're developing. But one of the constraints that people often deal with is that you have a limited amount of hardware upon which you can verify the behavior of your software. And we at Wind River have the same challenge. And when you find bugs, it can be very difficult to isolate, test, and close those bugs off such that we can meet the DO-178 requirements by establishing the requirements of completely satisfied in our testing and verification activities. So simulation is a natural way to try to ease that burden of effort. And what it enables one to do is to test early and often so you can reduce some of that risk. And while you're developing, it would be good to be able to do some testing. The good advantage, another advantage is that you can now test in the absence of real hardware. So the hardware team may be developing the hardware capabilities of your platform. They may not be complete, so you would naturally, if you had a simulation environment, you could start your work much sooner. The other advantage of simulation allows you to debug your software environment a little more naturally on a desktop environment, so to speak. It gives you the capability to do reverse execution and maybe even inject some faults in your testing process. So Wind River Simx does a lot of this stuff. So what is it? Well, what it does is allows you to take your target hardware and instantiate it into your desktop world, whether it be a Linux machine or a Windows laptop. It really doesn't matter. Your portable system that you're using, that we're all using in front of us right now, can host the Simx environment. And what it does is allows us to simulate the instruction set of the microprocessors and even the entire SoC for that matter. And then beyond the SoC, the hardware platform, it can also simulate that. And it can also simulate systems of composite hardware platforms. So there's really no limit into what can be simulated. But for DO-178 purposes in this discussion today, we'll try to focus mostly on one hardware platform for simulation. So very naturally, the Simx environment allows you to kind of break the rules of embedded development where you're waiting for hardware and you have limited ability to test and limited ability to see what's inside your test environment. The good thing is, in using a simulation environment, is it allows you to reduce certification risk. And what I have here kind of is a description of the natural write, build, unit test, integrate, and do system test of your software. So that's a very natural flow of how we build and test software today. But with simulation, you can allow easy automated testing. You can run tests in parallel. So the more simulators you have, the more tests you can run in parallel. So you can have a distributed team doing work. The other thing is you can do is have quick feedback to developers about potential failures. And I'll describe that particular feature of Simx in an upcoming slide here. But getting quick feedback on defects is very important to reducing that schedule risk in your projects. So the other thing that I talked about was parallelization of using Simx platform. So you can do automated testing with Simx. So if you want to run regression tests, and maybe your regression test might be run by a project team in another time zone, perhaps around halfway around the world, they can take your software unit on your test, run it on their servers, and execute and report results. And then other developers can go through and build tests on other servers. So you can have multiple things done in parallel, again, reducing that schedule and certification risk. The other natural feature that the simulation environment provides is that each of these environments or servers could be different configurations of your system. So you could be focusing on different subsets of your software application. And again, the more that the simulation can do in parallel, the better off you'll be from a risk and schedule point of view. So the feature I talked about earlier in terms of finding defects sooner and reporting those back to the developers, there's a feature in Simx called checkpointing. And if you look at the natural picture I have here on the screen on the left-hand side as a developer, denoted by the D there, and a tester denoted by a T. And so they're maybe working on different project teams. The developer builds their code and is ready to hand it off to the tester. The tester is writing their test cases, and lo and behold, the tester finds a defect and then has to work cooperatively with the developer to try to isolate and repeat that defect again so the developer can actually fix the bug under examination in this particular case. So without SimXFuse, it's going to be a feedback loop between the tester and the developer to try to isolate that defect. But with a checkpointing feature of SimX, what one can do then is the tester can use the simulation environment to go through and ensure that they can capture, save, restore, and share the simulation they ran with the developer and then provide that entire environment to the developer so they can easily replicate the defect. So now it's just an instant replay of what the tester saw. And that way the developer can either determine this is a test configuration issue or indeed it's a software bug. We can resolve it much more quickly by doing this with a checkpointing feature of SimX. The other thing that we've added to SimX more recently is the ability to debug in the cloud. We have what's called the Lab Cloud, and the Lab Cloud essentially allows you to extend your SimX environment to run your models and your simulation environment in the cloud, accessible to anyone around the world. That facilitates collaboration. What we're doing today is offering that for free, so if you are interested in downloading a feature like that, you can go to the website there, denoted, labcloud.windriver.com, and download your free trial copy of that to see how it works. So now let's try to get into the really interesting parts of using the simulation environment and getting DO178 credit. So the question customers always ask us is, can I use DO178 certification credit with SimX? And the answer is yes, unequivocally yes. The DO178, by definition, the simulator is a device or program that uses the same inputs and produces the same outputs derived from the original object code. SimX runs the as-built binaries that you would run in your target platform in the simulation environment. It's an instruction set simulator. It's a microprocessor SoC simulator, so the behavior will be identical. So yes, it qualifies by definition as a simulator under DO178. There are two main options our customers would have in using simulation for DO178 purposes. First option, and the simpler one, is to try to establish equivalence to the reference hardware. The other option is to qualify the simulator to meet some levels of DO330 requirements, and I'll get into the details of both of these options. The degree of effort is going to vary based on the approach, the credit sought, and of course, the qualification level that may apply. So as we think about using SimX as a simulation environment, I refer to DO178C, paragraph 443, where we say a simulator may need to be qualified, but one should address the differences between the target hardware and the simulation environment and the effects of these differences on the ability to detect errors and verify functionality. And those things should be considered as part of the qualification criteria. What has happened in the past is Wind River customers have used SimX as an equivalent platform in their verification activities, thereby eliminating the need for real hardware in some cases. And the use cases could vary depending on, you know, for example, conducting a change impact analysis from a certified code base, for coverage and testing purposes, to obtaining credit for requirements-based tests. And we've seen customers do both. The equivalence argument would need to show, at a minimum, the results obtained on the simulation platform are equivalent to those what we've seen on the real hardware. So again, you have to convince your certification authority that what you're seeing in the simulation world would be identical to what's being seen in the target platform. And since SimX runs the as-built binaries, it's an ideal candidate for equivalence. And again, it's a matter of getting your certification authorities comfortable with the approach you're using and the scope of the credit you're trying to take in the equivalence model. So briefly now, I'll talk about DO330 tool qualification, just to give you some background on it before we talk about the tool qualification criteria and levels because that's the second option that we can use CIMIX. So DL330 is used in conjunction with DL178C. It's the software tool qualification considerations, and it is written very much and structured very much like DL178C. It has a purpose. It defines the tool planning process, tool development activities and process, the integral processes of validation and verification, configuration management, quality assurance, approval liaison, tool qualification data, additional considerations, if there are any, that apply to the tool, and then ultimately what tool qualification credit you're seeking. And I'll elaborate in the next slides on what tool qualification credit really means in the context of DL330. So DL330 did a great thing for simulation environments like CIMIX, in that under DL178B, we had really two ends of a spectrum for tool usage. One is the tool produced outputs that were resident in the airborne software, and those were called development tools, and those had to be certified to the same level of the software that was being instantiated in that runtime environment. And then the other end of the spectrum was the verification tools that wouldn't put software into the runtime airborne system, but would be used to detect errors or verify results of that airborne system. And the activities that were involved in qualifying both those were very different. And they were, the development tool required lots of activities that were equivalent to doing the software, and the verification tools, of course, required much less rigorous in terms of development and verification effort, but still had to show that the tool didn't fail to detect an error. But in DL330, we had the beauty of allowing this third criteria, what they call criteria two tools, is that it allows for the elimination or reduction of verification processes other than that automated by the tool itself. So if you think about a test harness just reports pass-fail criteria, test pass-fail criteria as a result. You could qualify that reporting mechanism by verifying the behavior of that test harness. But in this particular model, we're using the tool to do more than just that. Maybe it's helping verify the behavior of the simulation environment. So DL330 allows a tool like CIMIX to be qualified in this criteria bucket, TQL4, which is a great thing because, again, it's kind of in that gray area. It's not just a verification tool, but it's not a development tool, although it could be considered one. So we have this area where we can use on level A or level B software at TQL4, and we have level C and D software that can be used at qualified at TQL5. So that's the benefit of using CIMIX in this environment. So as a DL330 TQL4 tool, CIMIX could be used to verify high and low level requirements-based tests. You could run those tests on a fully integrated simulated image. And again, it needs the qualification data to support that. And those are the kind of things that Wind River can help you with. And then CIMIX would allow you to test that full integrated software and get pass-fail test results in the simulated environment. Again, there needs to be the identicality established with the real hardware, and that's part of the tool qualification work that we do with CIMIX. You can also use CIMIX to do robustness verification, and I'll elaborate on what that is, but essentially it means that we're trying to validate, abnormal input conditions, abnormal output conditions, so testing exceptions, events, built-in test capabilities where you really have a difficult time doing that on real hardware. The other advantage we can do with CIMIX is to do it for structural coverage analysis, and we can integrate that in with a tool like LDRA, instrument the results and try to get some coverage data. And again, we're using that TQL4 qualification data. We can establish equivalence to the real hardware and use the advantages that CIMIX gives us there for controlling our execution environment very precisely. So we can reduce it, the benefit, of course, is reducing the time to do all that. So robustness verification, so again, we want to be able to isolate things that we can't naturally do in the real hardware world. So we're breaking hardware before to see exceptions and events and failure conditions could be robustly handled by the software. But in the simulated environment, we can do that very naturally. We can invoke any type of failure we want, any type of exception condition, and just invoke that through the simulation environment without having to rely on the hardware itself. So again, we can qualify Simix to do that kind of capability. The other advantage, as I spoke to earlier, is more complete control using Simix. We can get control over time. We can speed things up. We can slow things down. We can run things in reverse. We can use a checkpointing feature to quickly duplicate a bug in a different environment and get bugs fixed much more quickly than we otherwise would. So Simix puts you in complete control of your execution environment. You get full automation and limited control of your virtual targets. You can do this regression testing or certification credit testing as you wish. Customers will need to decide the degree of credit that they want to seek. Either they can use the equivalence argument, we have ways to do that, or we can do formal TQL4 qualification of Simix. If you're really interested in learning more about how to use it, contact us because we can certainly explain the options to you and hope that we can help you build a much more credible and efficient certification argument and verification data using a simulator like Simix. So here's what past customers say, and I'll conclude with this. Is we've had a number of aerospace and defense customers use Simix. In the examples here, we're able to considerably shorten the life cycle of verification. In some cases, for multiple months down to less than 1 month, fixing things in minutes as opposed to days, saving millions of dollars by not developing a full microprocessor and ASIC SoC environment, but verifying in a simulator first before actually sending it to the fab to have it produced. And then, of course, reducing the actual number of hardware platforms you buy, because if you now have a simulated environment, which your testers can use around the globe, certainly you can save the investment of buying real hardware. So with that, I'm going to turn it back over to our moderator, and we'll take questions now.
Great. Thanks, Joe, and thanks to you as well, Sean, for addressing some of those pain points with DO-178C development. That brings us to the Q&A portion of our event. Audience members, remember to keep those questions coming in, and we'll get to as many of them as we can with the remaining time. There's a question here for Sean. Sean, does achieving 100% statement coverage mean that data or control coupling analysis also results in 100% coverage?
Not necessarily. So that's a good question, and this is a big confusion. When you're doing control coupling analysis, you need to ensure that all the calling points have, in fact, been executed so that you have 100% procedure call coverage. Now, that doesn't mean that every procedure is calling the right procedure that it's supposed to or function that it's supposed to and is congruent to the way the architecture and the requirements require it to be. So that level of analysis has to be done post looking at the procedure call coverage. In data coupling, just because you have 100% coverage doesn't mean that you're updating global track data that you're getting off of an interface every other frame like you're supposed to. Maybe you're updating every fourth frame and it's stale. So to be able to understand how those software components are actually coupled together and how the set used pairs of data elements are being affected, blanket coverage is not good enough. You have to be able to look at how that data element is being exercised, how it's being written to and read from. So it's really used in conjunction with structural coverage, and there's a good deal more here, and I know the person that wrote the question, so I'll make sure to forward them along a white paper that gets into detail.
Great. Here's one for Joe. Joe, what hardware platform does Simix support right now?
Well, virtually, we support all SoCs and microprocessors that are common in the market today. So whether it's an Intel part, whether it's an ARM-based part, or whether it's a Freescale-based part, we have support and do support all of those architectures. The hardware platforms we support have varied. There are some COTS platforms we support a subset of the functionality. There are others that are custom that we've supported that are built by our end customer that have given us the specifications for their hardware. We have modeled those. So we're really flexible in terms of what we can support, but the common COTS microprocessors and SoCs we have libraries and models for today.
Okay. Here's one for Sean, but Joe, if you'd like to add something, feel free to chime in. For tools today, do they detect? Is it possible for them to detect code in low-level implementations that aren't called for at the specification level, at the higher level? An example of this would be the introduction of hidden code that could potentially be malicious or accidentally inherited object code.
Sure. So it's using tooling and methodology together that gets you there. So let's say you run through 100 test cases to verify 50 requirements, and then you have 98% code coverage. And then you look at the 2% of the code that's not covered, and you find that there's no requirement, low-level requirement linked to it. That's one quick way of finding out if there's finding some code that wasn't intended to be there. Right. If every piece of code is not linked to a requirement, that's another way of finding out if there's code in there that wasn't intended to be there. So there are several approaches from that standpoint. With respect to object code, if you run through 100 test cases that give you 100% statement branch and MCDC coverage, and then you regress those test cases on the instrument and link together object files generated, then what you end up finding is little pieces and slivers of code that the compiler might have inserted in. So you can, in effect, isolate unexecuted or potentially malicious, hidden code within your object code. So there's a few different ways to flush these things out, and it's usually a combination of tooling and methodology to flush out those gaps.
Yeah, and I'll add here, the other important aspect to that meaning ensuring that there's nothing unverified or hidden in the code, there's another aspect to this that people have to consider. And it's, there can be very laborious, and it is requirements. Effectively, GO-178 says you're going to do requirements-based tests, and those requirements-based tests will be executed, and then you'll analyze the coverage. So if your requirements aren't fully testing the behavior of the software, one indicator will be the coverage analysis reporting. But if you're not enumerating enough in terms of low-level requirements and verifying those low-level requirements, you might get incidental coverage and could miss something that's hidden in terms of behavior. So the best way to try to insulate yourself from that is to make sure your requirements fully describe what the implementation shall do. And that way, your pass-fail criteria as well as your coverage analysis can help ensure if there's no functionality there that is unexplored.
Great. And before we move on to the next question, just want to remind the audience again to keep your questions coming in, and we'll get to them in the remaining time. Joe, back to you. Is it possible to qualify Simics to meet tool quality level 1 of DO330 so that you could use a simulation environment for all of development and verification?
It's possible, and I wouldn't say it might be economically feasible, but it's possible, because in the end, the technologies that we're modeling in Simics are equivalent to building the microprocessor with VHDL and the SoC with VHDL logic. So in effect, if we're doing TQL1 on that model, we're essentially doing the equivalent of DO254 on the CPU or SoC itself. So it's a very labor-intensive effort, and so the return on that investment would have to be very high. It is theoretically possible. There's nothing technically that would constrain you, but it would really be a choice of economics as to whether it would be worth it. Wind River hasn't yet committed to doing anything like that at the moment. We're targeting the lower tool qualification levels for Simics.
Okay. So as of now, are there plans to qualify Simics to DO330?
So we are engaging with customers at the moment who are interested in TQL4. Which I described earlier in that slide, which is that criteria 2 slide for use at level A, B, and even C, D applications.
Great. Now turning to continuous integration, which is a big topic right now across industry. Sean, how does continuous integration in Jenkins work with LDRA's tool suite?
Yes, so basically all of our analysis and regression executions from our tools can be linked right into Jenkins. In fact, we're about to release a plugin that makes this whole process extremely easy, but several of our current customers are plugging in because they want the agility. They know they need the rigor of decomposing down everything and lots of granularity, lots of really well-written tests, lots of coverage, but they want to run this every night, see where they are. They want to be able to get functionality in quickly. So technically, and from a technology standpoint, it plugs in very cleanly into Jenkins and various other continuous integration tools, and the reports can then have the XML overlays that lets you extract the data and get that granular information back into Jenkins, so you can see all that reporting. And the way our TV Manager tool works and links back into that information, you're able to preserve the visibility into the V and see which tests have met which requirements and all of that, while running everything in sort of a linear mindset, running all your tests in bulk at the end of the day or overnight. So there's a very big demand out there in this world to bring agility and continuous integration into the safety critical hard real time environments, and it's working. You just have to work out the methodology, and the technology hooks together pretty well.
Right. Great. Here's a follow-up for you, Sean. How does LDRA integrate with Simulink, SCADE, Rhapsody, and other modeling tools?
Sure. So in three primary different ways. And ultimately, if you're in the DO178 world and you're using Simulink, SCADE, or Rhapsody, you may or may not be generating code from those tools. Definitely from a couple of them, you will certainly be generating code. And the idea is to be able to allow people to develop quickly in the modeling environment and create tests in the model, and then being able to verify the model behavior as well as they can, and then push the generated code out into TB Run, one of our tools, for instance, that'll, as well as bring in the existing test cases that we're creating in the model into TB Run, so you can regress those tests on the code, on the target hardware, and verify your executable object code behavior as it's expected to be. And each one of these tools are really well developed with different types of extensibility, so this type of data can be imported out of it. And they're becoming more and more relevant each day in this environment because they're providing that level of extensibility.
Good deal. Here's a question that both of you could answer. I'll pose it to Sean first, and then Joe, if you'd like, you can jump in afterwards. Moving away from Simix now, looking at VxWorks, is there an integration between LDRA and VxWorks? And if so, does it support IMA, multicore?
Absolutely, and this has been on our horizon. Of course, we've been integrating with VxWorks for many, many years, but as time and space partition operating systems are becoming par for the course, it's very important to be able to do things like merge coverage on the same process on two different partitions with very little overhead. It's very important to be able to run the same task or same process on multiple cores, or run a low-level test on one of four different cores because it has some specific peripheral you want to engage that test with. So absolutely, IMA and multi-core support is integral to our roadmap, and very, very various customers of ours are using them for level A systems now.
Yeah,
anything you'd like to add, Sean?
Yep, I'll elaborate on that. So, the Simix models that we produce do include support for multi-core processors. And, of course, as we know, multi-core processors are very complex. There's a lot of shared resources in them that have to be identified. And so you can use the Simix model, whether it's a Freescale part or an Intel part, to try to verify the behavior of that functionality, especially in an IMA system where you're having multiple levels of criticality on one or more cores. So Simix does play a key role there. And again, it's going to be based on the specific CPU or SoC that you're using.
Great. Now back to you, Joe. Can you share one or two brief examples of how to establish an equivalence argument in Simix for DO178 certification?
Yeah, that's a good question. And we get this question a lot from our customers. So how do I get equivalence? How do I do that? And one way that we did this, and I'll give you an example of what we did at Wind River, was that we've got a lot of test suites for our operating environments like VxWorks 6.5.3. So we certainly can test that on a specific hardware platform, get results, whether it's a Freescale part or an Intel part. And knowing those results, we could take that same test suite with the same VxWorks 653 binary, instantiate it on Simix, and run either a subset or even all the tests to show that, guess what, these two things are identical. The results are the same. So I can establish equivalence in accordance with the DO-178 definition. Once I do that, I can extend that argument to say I can run other tests. I can run tests on the board support software using the same operating environment. So as long as I don't change or adulterate the environment too much, the accredit that I'm seeking should apply. Again, it's going to be a case-by-case argument, but that's essentially how you use equivalence, is you want to try to prove that you get identicality between the simulation platform and the real hardware. And that could be a subset of tests, or it could be the complete suite of tests. It's really going to vary on how much credit you want to apply thereafter. So then you can take that, make software changes later, do a change impact analysis, re-verify using Simix, and get credit for it. So that's one example of using equivalence argument. You have to document that in your certification plans and, of course, show justification. So that would be one area we could use equivalence and equivalence argument and get DO-178 credit.
Wow, excellent. Great answer. Unfortunately, that brings us to the end of our time today. And for those of you who had questions we didn't get to, we'll be sure to have representatives from the appropriate company follow up with you. I want to thank our speakers again, Joe Blott of Wind River and Sean Bhattacharya of LDRA. And we at Open Systems Media and Wind River and LDRA would also like to thank you, the audience, for attending today and contributing some great questions remotely. This eCast will be posted online at the URL shown on your screen within 24 hours, and an audio-only podcast will be made available there as well. You can do a web search with the keywords embedded space e-cast and find all of Open Systems Media's eCasts available for download there as MP3s. Thank you again for attending, and have a great day.